From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the nuclear crises with Iran and North Korea and how the Bush administration has handled them. We talk with Joseph Cirincione, author of the new book Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He's the Vice President for National Security at the Center for American Progress and spent 8 years as the Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Andy Richter is starring in a new sitcom as a suburban accountant who's mistaken for a private eye and ends up becoming one. Richter used to be Conan O'Brien's sidekick on Late Night. Our TV critic David Bean Cooley will talk with Richter about his new show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Here's the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his new book, Bomb Scare, my guest Joseph Cirincione writes about the history and future of nuclear weapons. We invited him to talk about the nuclear crises with Iran and North Korea and how they've been handled by the Bush administration. Cirincione is the Vice President for National Security at the Center for American Progress and teaches at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. He's the former director for nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and has served on the professional staff of the House Armed Services Committee. Joseph Cirincione, welcome back to Fresh Air. This month, you published a paper called Contain and Engage, a New Strategy for Resolving the Nuclear Crisis with Iran. And in that paper, you wrote, we have five policy options now. And I'll just like run through what you say those five are. One is maintain the status quo of muddling through. Two, non-military efforts to replace the current regime. Three, military attacks on known Iranian nuclear facilities. Four, a grand bargain. Five, decisive diplomacy to roll back Iran's nuclear programs. You reject all of those options with the exception of a grand bargain with Iran and decisive diplomacy to roll back Iran's nuclear programs. And then you end up eliminating a grand bargain, too. what do you mean by a grand bargain, and why do you eliminate that one as well?
You know, the grand bargain is proposed by several people that say, look, the only way to solve the Iranian problem is to put all the issues on the table and negotiate a comprehensive deal, including changing Iran's position on Israel, which, of course, is crucial to do, ending their support for Hezbollah and Hamas, and from the Iranian point of view, you know, resolving some of the issues that came out of the 1979 revolution. The problem with that is that it puts too much baggage on the cart at this point. I don't believe that either government in Tehran or in Washington is ready for this kind of approach, and it hinges on resolving all these issues at once rather than concentrating on the most important issue, which right now is their nuclear program. That's the thing we have to stop right now. And I believe you can do that, that there's room for compromise now with the help of our allies, not a U.S.-Iran one-on-one death match, but a comprehensive approach that involves our allies, including Iran's allies, in convincing them that they have to turn away from this nuclear program. And they will do that if they have a sense that not only will this nuclear program be resolved, but some of these other issues can then be resolved down the road. That's the way to approach it, step by step, in a much more practical, pragmatic way.
So what do you think decisive diplomacy would look like? What are some of the carrots and sticks you think could be on the table?
We've seen some of this already in the way we've dealt with Libya and now in the negotiations with North Korea, where we're actually having direct negotiations. And we're basically saying that to these countries, and we should say to Iran, that we will satisfy your security concerns if you satisfy ours. We will end our efforts to overthrow your regime if you end those programs that are threatening us. And by the way, if you do that, there are substantial economic and political benefits that will flow to you. In other words, convince them that their future is more secure, more profitable without nuclear weapons than it is with nuclear weapons.
So how would we do that? What would we offer them?
In the beginning, we would sit down with Iran and talk about how to freeze their nuclear operations right now, their uranium enrichment capabilities, and we would then suspend temporarily our sanctions against them. That would have an immediate and dramatic impact on Iran's economy. We would then talk about ways that Iran could be assured that they could go ahead with nuclear power, that is, building reactors, as long as we set up mechanisms where the fuel for those reactors was supplied outside the country. They didn't have the capability to make the fuel themselves. Most countries don't have that capability. Most countries, and there are over 40 with nuclear reactors, buy it from the five or six countries that already produce it. And we could set up an international arrangement that the Iranians could make sure that they have a guaranteed supply. It couldn't be cut off because one country decides they don't want to sell it to Iran anymore. And in return, we would start moving towards a process of normalization of relations. Now, this is the hard part for some Americans, particularly some in the administration. At the end of this road, we would be recognizing the Islamic Republic of Iran. We would reestablish an embassy in Tehran. Tehran would have an embassy in the United States. We would normalize our relations. We would be accepting this regime as is. And then we would work on these other issues that we have issues with. But they're the same issues we have with other countries. We have issues with Egypt and Pakistan, our allies, over their democracy, their human rights, their foreign policy. We would recognize that that this is what happens. Countries differ over these policies. We're not going to solve them all. But most importantly, we will resolve the nuclear question first.
Let me ask what may sound like a dumb question. Why does it benefit Iran for us to recognize them? Like, what do they get from that?
Well, one thing Iran wants is to be to have access to the world economy. They want to have the Western markets and Western investment that they need to modernize their economy. They are rich in a couple of natural resources, oil and natural gas, but have a relatively basic industrial operation right now. And they need that kind of investment to one, modernize their oil exploration, oil extraction industries, their gas refining industries, to modernize their auto production industries, and to open up trade that will allow them to develop exports other than oil, natural gas, carpets, and pistachios, which is all they export right now, and prosper as a nation. Here's a basic fact you should know about Iran. The Iranian economy, because of the population boom, needs to create about 800,000 jobs a year. It's creating about 400,000 right now. That means there is a growing cohort of young, unemployed people. That is a very dangerous situation for any country. That's what the Iranian regime needs to reverse, and they can't reverse it without access to world markets. That's the big carrot that we have to offer Iran, the big prize for them.
Do you think the Bush administration is planning to attack either Iraq's nuclear facilities or to try to overthrow the Ahmadinejad government?
I think the chances of this go up and down month by month, almost week by week. Currently, I think there's a relatively low chance of that, that there's maybe 15% chance that we would actually start a war with Iran, but that could change. And the reason is that there's always been this factional struggle inside the administration over which way to go. So you have some people, and I would include Vice President Cheney in that, who believe that the only solution is to overthrow the Iranian regime. And you see this point of view expressed weekly in the neoconservative press, the writings of Bill Kristol in the Weekly Standard, or Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post, or Max Boot in the Los Angeles Times, writings coming out of the American Enterprise Institute. All of them say we have to start a war with Iran. We have to attack Iran. So that point of view is reflected in some in the administration. Right now, I would say that's a minority view, and that the military is against this overwhelmingly. The State Department is against this. The Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, has no interest in this, and that's a dramatic turn from his predecessor, Donald Rumsfeld, who was more in favor of this option. And the U.S. is so bogged down in Iraq, I think, that we're not likely to do it. However, the problem is that you see these moves taking place, deploying aircraft carrier battle groups to the Gulf, Patriot missiles to the Gulf, which are only useful against Iran's missiles, have nothing to do with the insurgency or the civil war we're fighting. This kind of arrests of Iranian diplomats inside Iraq. These kind of provocative actions can raise the tensions in the region so that we might have a situation where some incident happens, some spark. Next time we try to arrest Iranians, they resist, and there's a firefight between U.S. and Iranian forces. An Iranian patrol boat strays too close to a U.S. Task force and is shot up. This kind of spark could provoke a conflict. So there's still that concern. I'm still worried about this. But a deliberate war, deliberate attack with Iran, right now I give that a fairly low probability.
Now, Russia told Iran this week that it will withhold nuclear fuel for Iran's power plant unless Iran complies with the UN demands to suspend its uranium enrichment program. How do you interpret this ultimatum?
This is one of the great benefits of a multilateral approach to these problems. It's not just the U.S. demanding that Iran end this program. It's first the entire U.N. Security Council, which is united in this demand, and most importantly, allies of Iran are telling it this. Russia is the main commercial partner with Iran. They are making several billion dollars in constructing the nuclear power facility in Bushehr. And they are under contract to supply the fuel for that facility, which is supposed to open up in the spring of this year. They're now saying, we're not going to give you the fuel. We're not going to allow you to go ahead with this nuclear power program unless you stop the enrichment facilities that are giving all of us concern. That is a huge lever that we now have over Iran, and it's only made possible because the skillful diplomacy of the last several months that has kept Russia in this mix, that has kept the UN Security Council united. It's paying dividends now.
Who's behind that skillful diplomacy?
You've got to give credit to the State Department, to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. You didn't see this kind of work when John Bolton was there. We got some of it, but it's really Condoleezza Rice that's pushed it over the edge, that's prevented some in the administration wanting to go further. They wanted a stronger, tougher sanctions resolution with more teeth, and I understand that. But by compromising, by having a relatively weak sanctions resolution that hits 10 companies, 12 individuals, for example, you were able to keep everybody on board. So you kept China and Russia on board. And then when Iran didn't comply, you were able this week to get another sanctions resolution and these supporting actions that you're now seeing. This is powerful stuff. This is what people mean by decisive diplomacy or even coercive diplomacy, forcing Iran into a corner, letting it know it doesn't have any options here. But then, and here's the trick, you have to give them a way out. You have to open the door. You have to let them know that there's a solution to this where they can save face and, in fact, prosper as long as they move in a more cooperative direction and end their confrontational approach.
What would that doorway out be?
The doorway out would be a diplomatically arranged a set of negotiations where Iran, for example, declares that it's ready to start talking without preconditions, but it's understood that the day negotiations start, they will suspend their uranium enrichment operations. At that point, the U.S. could join the talks because it's met the U.S. demand. And then at the same time, the UN Security Council suspends its sanctions against Iran, giving Iran what would be seen as a victory, or the leaders could trumpet as a victory. And this, what the Europeans call dual suspension, you know, accomplishes what both sides want. The suspensions end for Iran, the uranium enrichment program ends for us, and then you start a series of step-by-step negotiations that could lead to a recognition that Iran has a right to enrich uranium, but the promise not to actually exercise that right, that is not to open up those facilities again for an extended period of time. People talk about 10 years or so until Iran has established or reestablished trust that it can do this. And we have an opportunity to perhaps find another way for Iran, a multinational facility in the region that Iran could participate in that could make this fuel rather than have a national facility on their own territory. There's a lot of other doors then open up at that point. It's important to get them into that process and get the talks going.
Now, you credit skillful diplomacy with the fact that Russia gave an ultimatum to Iran. Is the ultimatum in part, though, because Iran owes Russia money?
People like to think that all these things are resolved on a very high level, that they're involve statements of principle on one side or the other. But, you know, money plays a big part in U.S. weapons decisions, on other countries' diplomatic decisions, and that does seem to be playing a role here. Iran is in a credit crunch, partially because of the sanctions, some imposed by the U.N., some imposed unilaterally by the U.S., that has caused investors' confidence in Iran to collapse. So people aren't putting money into Iran. This has caused a market slowdown in the Iranian economy, a plummet of its stock market. And it means that Iran hasn't had the cash to pay Russia for the work that Russia's doing. And that's part of the reason Russia's now holding up the fuel rod. So it's never a pure mix of a secret deal cooked up between the U.S. and Russia or Russia operating with the purest of motives. Several things are going on here. One is diplomacy. One is just business.
My guest is Joseph Cirincione, Vice President for National Security at the Center for American Progress and author of the new book, Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joseph Cirincione, and he's the author of the new book, Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He's the director for nuclear policy at the Center for American Progress. Let's talk a little bit about North Korea. Where does North Korea stand in stopping its nuclear program under pressure from the United States and other countries?
We've made a lot of progress in just the past few months, and we've gotten talks going again. We've gotten North Korea to suspend its program, so it's not testing nuclear weapons anymore. Remember, they tested a nuclear weapon on October 9th of last year, and the talks look promising. Both sides have started to make compromises. Nothing's going to be easy about this, but it looks like we're on a road where we can at least freeze the North Korean program, going back to the basic arrangement of the 1990s under the Clinton administration, and quite possibly achieve President Bush's goal of a complete, verifiable, and irreversible dismantlement of this program.
Last October, North Korea tested its first nuclear weapon, which used plutonium. And the Bush administration has accused North Korea of also pursuing a secret program to create a bomb using enriched uranium. And it was the threat of enriched uranium that I think really escalated the showdown with North Korea. Now intelligence officers are saying that there really are serious doubts about how far that uranium enrichment program has actually come. Why is uranium more of a threat than a plutonium-enriched bomb?
No, not really. There's the two different routes to a nuclear weapon. We pursued both during the Manhattan Project. The two ways to make a bomb are either to enrich uranium to weapons grade, and that involves currently centrifuges. That's what Iran is doing, and we had a similar program in the 1940s. Or you generate plutonium in a reactor and then separate it out, and that's what North Korea did, and we also did that. So the two bombs are roughly equal. Neither one is actually more sort of deadly than the other, that you get the same yield from either uranium or a plutonium bomb. People use different considerations of what they can actually get their hands on.
So why was the idea that North Korea was pursuing a uranium program considered such a threat, knowing that they were already doing plutonium?
Well, we could do a whole show just on this. In fact, I just wrote an article on this that went up on the foreign policy website this week called We Got Tubed Again. And the issue was that American officials discovered in the late 1990s and then early 2000 that it appeared that North Korea was importing some centrifuges from the AQ Khan black market. This is the Pakistan scientist who sold centrifuges to Libya, Iran, and now it appears to North Korea. And we had pretty good evidence that they had about 20 centrifuges, nowhere near what they would need for a real program, but an indication of some interest. And this would be a violation of the agreement where they agreed to freeze all their nuclear weapons activities. But then we thought that we detected the sale of aluminum tubes, same issue that came up in the war with Iraq. In fact, it was at the same period, 2002, where we were saying that aluminum tubes imported by Saddam Hussein were a sign of his intent to build programs, that officials were saying the same about North Korea. It now turns out that that evidence was a lot sketchier than we realized. We know that was the case with Iraq, and now it appears that way with North Korea again, that the same individuals who cherry-picked the intelligence and exaggerated the issue in order to justify a war with Iraq cherry-picked the intelligence and exaggerated an issue in order to tear up the agreement with North Korea, walk out of the talks, and end discussions. And the issue it would be, if this was true, if they really were, as the CIA then said in their estimate, constructing a uranium enrichment plant that could be ready by mid-decade and producing 1 to 2 bombs a year, that could be an extremely serious program. On the other hand, if it was just sort of cheating on the edges, fiddling around with 20 centrifuges, that's something that could be much more easily stopped. The North Koreans, in fact, when confronted with this evidence, agreed to roll all this into negotiations, and they would suspend this and make this part of a general resolution. It was the U.S. side who walked out, decided that negotiations were no longer useful, and ended any process of stopping North Korea's program. North Korea responded by opening up its reactor, producing more plutonium, producing more bombs, and then testing one on October 9th of last year.
So you're saying that North Korea made more progress on its nuclear weapons program as a result of the cherry-picking of intelligence on their weapons program?
Because Bush administration officials used exaggerated and misleading intelligence to end an agreement with North Korea, North Korea was able to quadruple its supply of plutonium, actually test a nuclear weapon, and threaten a nuclear arms race in Northeast Asia. By walking away from the negotiations, the Bush administration vastly increased the threat that we faced from North Korea. We're now trying to walk back.
We're saying we're walking toward the same kind of agreement that the Bush administration rejected before. That we're working hard to get back to where we were.
We're now watching a process in the Bush administration of the pendulum swinging back of these hardline overthrow regime strategies, having proven their failure, having proven that they make matters worse, being rejected by others in the administration, and the president now walking back to sort of recapture what we could have had at a much cheaper price 3-4 years earlier.
Joseph Cirincione is the author of the new book, Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He's the Vice President for National Security at the Center for American Progress and teaches at Georgetown University. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts at pewtrusts.org, funding the international traveling exhibition, Benjamin Franklin, In Search of a Better World, now in Denver. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Andy Richter, Conan O'Brien's former sidekick, is starring in a new sitcom as an accountant who accidentally becomes a private eye. Coming up, Richter talks with our TV critic, David Bianculli. And Joseph Cirincione talks about the threat of nuclear terrorism. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Joseph Cirincione, author of the new book Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He's the Vice President for National Security at the Center for American Progress and the former Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We've been talking about the nuclear crises with Iran and North Korea. The British Parliament recently voted to spend $40 billion to create a new generation of nuclear submarines to carry Trident missiles. So how does that look, do you think, to be developing a new nuclear program at a time when England and the United States are trying to pressure Iran and North Korea to stop theirs?
The British decision is a major step backwards. There is no real military justification for Great Britain having several hundred nuclear weapons. They don't need them for their security. There's no real mission for these weapons. It's really, you know, a matter of prestige and pride, sort of clinging to this, the remnants of great power status. You know, when you look at why countries acquire nuclear weapons, and I go into this in the book, the two top reasons are power, is to secure their own territorial integrity or project their power in the region, and prestige, which is largely the reason, for example, France acquired nuclear weapons in the 1960s or India exploded a nuclear bomb in 1998. And you see that prestige factor operating here with the United Kingdom. We're a great power, they're saying. We have nuclear weapons. That is a terrible message to be sending to the rest of the world. How are you going to convince other countries not to take this shortcut to great power status if the countries with the weapons keep insisting that they're absolutely essential to their national security? The same is true for us. How are you going to convince other countries they shouldn't have one nuclear weapon when the most powerful military power the world has ever seen insists that it needs 10,000 nuclear weapons for its security? If we need them, why don't they? If we see these as adding to our prestige, why shouldn't other countries? So you can't ultimately solve the problem of proliferation, of other countries getting weapons, if you're not willing to confront your own addiction to these weapons. You can't get your kids to stop smoking if you have a two-pack-a-day habit. You both have to quit together.
When you look at the possibility of detonating a nuclear weapon, large or small, do you think that that possibility comes most from terrorists?
Absolutely. And the reason is that there is a large supply of nuclear weapons and nuclear material in the world, and now we have the addition of messianic or apocalyptic terrorist groups who, unlike most terrorist groups, would actually seek mass destruction, would actually seek to kill large numbers of civilians. And we know they're trying to get this material. The 9/11 Commission report documented the case of Osama bin Laden spending $1.5 million to buy what he thought was highly enriched uranium, bomb material. Turned out to be a scam. He bought radioactive junk. We know Osama bin Laden met right before 9/11 with three or four Pakistani scientists. They came to his training camps in Afghanistan, nuclear scientists engaged in their Pakistani nuclear program. We just recently had a case of a former technician from the country of Georgia selling highly enriched uranium to what he thought was a terrorist group, turned out to be a sting operation by the Georgian authorities, but he had 2 kilograms of this stuff. This was the real stuff, weapons grade. You need about 20, 25 kilograms to build a bomb, but he had, you know, a good chunk of that ready to sell. This is a real problem, a real threat. We no longer worry about the fate of the Earth, in Jonathan Schell's phrase from his 1980s book about a global thermonuclear war that will destroy the planet. That was the great threat of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. But now we do worry about the fate of our cities, about a single terrorist group getting the material that they need or getting a weapon itself, smuggling it into a U.S. port or airfield and detonating it. It just takes one bomb to destroy a city.
Now, you who really believe in negotiations with countries like Iran and North Korea about their nuclear programs, do you believe that negotiations could be at all effective with extremist terrorist groups who, as you say, have apocalyptic visions and would be happy to see mass destruction?
No. You have to have a completely different approach. And the key is to get at the supply. Fortunately, there's a limited amount of this material. There's still, I think we estimate about 1,500 tons of this material in the world, but we know where almost all of it is. And here's the better news. We have programs that are designed to go out and secure that, lock it up tighter than it currently is, and eliminate large portions of it. People may not realize that we have a program, for example, to buy back highly enriched uranium from Russia. We've bought 500 tons of this stuff already. We then blend it down with natural uranium, turn it into fuel rods, and put it in our nuclear reactors. So about 1 in every 10 light bulbs in the United States right now is powered by material that used to be in Russian warheads. Now, that's material that the terrorists can no longer get. We're eliminating it. We have programs to do all this. The problem is they're proceeding at a snail's pace. But if you were to accelerate these programs, if you would fund them at, say, triple the rate, right now we spend about $1 billion a year doing this, or about what we spend every 3.5 days in Iraq. If you were to triple that and put a senior official, say a deputy national security advisor, in the White House in charge of this, you could virtually eliminate the threat of nuclear terrorism within the next 4 years. In fact, I'm waiting for a presidential candidate to realize this and take this issue up. I think it would be enormously popular. So we know how to deal with nuclear terrorism, and it doesn't have anything to do with convincing the terrorists or negotiating with the terrorists. It involves stopping them from getting the material in the first place. As Sam Nunn says, every step after the terrorists can get the material is easier for them to carry out and harder for us to stop. That's why the struggle against nuclear terrorism, as President Bush says, really does have to take place over there so that we don't have to deal with it over here. We have to go to where the supplies are, secure and eliminate those supplies, and then we can virtually eliminate the threat of nuclear terrorism in a very short time.
Where are the supplies?
Well, most of the supplies right now are in the states of the former Soviet Union, a lot in Russia, and our programs have secured about half those materials so far. The bad news is we haven't secured the other half, but they're also in research reactors that we and the Russians sprinkled around the globe during the Atoms for Peace days when we thought that nuclear power was the energy source of the future and electricity would be so cheap we wouldn't even have to meter it. At least that's what nuclear power witnesses told Congress in the 1950s. And we spread these little research reactors around. Unfortunately, a lot of them used as fuel highly enriched uranium, same stuff as bomb material. And there's now about 100 reactors in 40 countries that still have highly enriched uranium, many of them enough to make one, two, or a half dozen bombs. So we have a program in place. It's called the Global Threat Reduction Initiative, started by the Bush administration, that goes out to these facilities. And for about $2 billion a pop, we either shut down the reactor or we replace it with low-enriched uranium, convert it to a different kind of reactor. Everybody's happy with that deal. The trouble is we're only doing about 5 or 6 conversions a year. And at the current pace, it'll take us until 2020, 2030 to finish the job. We have to take that program and accelerate it so we get to the uranium in Vietnam, for example, before Osama bin Laden does.
I have a nuclear energy question for you. The image of nuclear energy seems to have really improved recently. Instead of it being seen largely as a very dangerous source of energy for a lot of people who were its critics, it's seen now as a good alternative to relying on foreign oil. And I really am curious about your perspective on the relative safety and the relative, you know, merits or problems of nuclear energy.
Well, I've have to admit I've softened on nuclear energy for the same reasons others have, that the threat of global warming is so serious. And when you look at what you have to do, it's hard to see how you stop global warming without having nuclear power in the mix somewhere. The trouble is that nuclear power creates its own set of problems, and the industry still hasn't resolved the 4 fundamental problems it has, and those involve cost, extremely expensive, especially without government subsidies. Safety, if something goes wrong with the nuclear reactor, you have a much bigger problem than if your coal plant stops working. Proliferation, that is, how do you stop countries from making the fuel for these reactors, which is and using that same equipment to make bombs for their military. And finally, waste. Where do you put the stuff? This has not been solved in 62 years. We still don't know what to do with the waste. I just came back from Nevada. I was talking out there about the book. And I'm telling you, the people in Nevada do not want to open up Yucca Mountain, which is the solution for our waste problem, where we're supposed to take all the waste from the 103 reactors that we have and ship it all to Nevada and bury it in the desert. They're saying, oh, no, you're not. And I got to believe that. I got to believe that this state's going to stop that Yucca Mountain. And if that does, that means you basically, it's like the sewer backing up. Everything backs all the way up to your local reactor, which has been sitting on these spent fuel rods and now has no place to put them. I don't know how you solve that problem. So there's a lot of issues with nuclear energy that have to be resolved before it's really going to be part of the global warming solution.
Joseph Cirincione, thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
It's my pleasure. It's an honor to be on your show. Thank you for having me, Terry.
Joseph Cirincione is the author of the new book, Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He's the Vice President for National Security at the Center for American Progress. Coming up, Conan O'Brien's former sidekick Andy Richter is starring in a new sitcom. Richter will talk about it with our TV critic David Bianculli after a break. This is Fresh Air. Andy Richter left his role as Conan O'Brien's sidekick on Late Night in 2000 to act in movies and on TV. He had a couple of sitcoms that didn't last long. Now he's back with a new sitcom that's very funny and has a great team behind it. The new sitcom was co-created by Conan O'Brien and former Late Night head writer Jonathan Groff. It's called Andy Barker PI and airs Thursday nights on NBC. In a moment, Richter will talk about it with our TV critic David Bianculli. Richter plays an accountant named Andy Barker who leaves his job at a big firm to open his own office in a suburban strip mall. He's unable to get his own clients until one day when a mysterious Russian woman comes into his office thinking he's the previous tenant, a crusty private detective. The woman hands Andy an envelope full of cash and asks him to find her husband. Because Andy needs the money, he takes on the case and embarks on a dual career as a private eye and certified public accountant. His partner in crime solving is Simon, the guy who manages the video store below him. Simon, played by Tony Hale, is constantly pointing out the parallels between their case and movie plots. In this scene from the pilot, Andy and Simon chase down a couple of thugs to a dark warehouse and confront them. Andy and Simon are soon surprised when the mysterious Russian woman who hired Andy walks in and joins the thugs. One of the thugs has his arm in his jacket, where he appears to have a gun pointed at Andy and Simon.
Hello, fellas.
Who's this?
Lou Stasiak.
Actually, I'm Andy Barker. I'm an accountant.
And I'm Simon. I manage a video store. Godfather one, am I right?
Simon.
You know. Michael and Enzo the Baker come out of the hospital, and they don't have guns, so they put their fingers in their pockets to intimidate Salazar's men.
This guy's not carrying a gun. I made a mistake.
Okay. That was pretty scary. And a little bit rude. So to make it up to us, why don't you just let Mr. Kerensky go?
Oh, but we went to so much trouble to find him.
You. Boy, do I have a bone to pick with you. You lied to me. And I'm no expert on your particular business model, but do you even own this warehouse?
No.
So you're renting. Well, you're throwing your money away, or else you're squatting, which is a whole
beat them to death.
That was from Andy Barker, PI, on NBC. My guest is Andy Richter, the star of that show. What tone are you guys going for with this comedy?
I've been saying, this is what I want it to be. I want it to sort of be a Quinn Martin comedy, kind of like if the streets of San Francisco had jokes. And that's, well, you know, it is sort of a hybrid of a show in that it's a comedy, but it also, there's just kind of the classic Barnaby Jones, Ironsides, you know, you name any number of them, detective shows where there is a crime that needs to be solved, in this case, in a half an hour. It's secondary to the comedy, but we definitely want to have that feel. And with the music, we don't want it to just be pure nostalgia or purely referential. But I did sort of want there to be sort of the bongos and flute music, you know, that something that does have a bit of an anachronistic feel.
Now, you're shooting single camera, and you've been in a lot of movies, but what are the benefits of shooting single camera when you're trying to make this type of comedy?
It's a lot easier to set a tone. It's a lot easier to do a story that is transportational, you know, that has some sort of effect of taking you somewhere else. Because when you're in front of an audience, it's hard to believe you're anywhere other than on a soundstage in front of an audience. And it just wouldn't work to have a bunch of laughter going on throughout a show like this. You need to be able to, I think, suspend your disbelief somewhat. And I also think that you need, with this show like this, it's very dependent on, you know, it's not just set up joke. It's, you know, there are jokes, but they're a little more subtle, and many of them are dependent upon pacing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I actually find frustrating about working in a multi-camera sitcom on a set in front of an audience is that the audience is the one, they're the ones with their foot on the accelerator in terms of your the pacing of a scene, that you have to hold for their laughter. You can't just kind of plow through and make the pacing your own. They're in control. Maybe I'm a control freak. I don't like to share that responsibility. I'm multi-camera sitcoms too tend to breed a lack of discipline, and it's very hard to avoid grandstanding or really, you know, slicing the ham extra thick when you've got an audience of people really ready to laugh at you. It's almost impossible to resist that urge.
Andy, the 6 episodes of your series were actually available on NBC.com to watch in their entirety before the series premiered on the network.
Mm-hmm. They're there right now.
I don't know that this has ever been done before with a network show. Do you think this is a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't really know. they told me this was going to happen, and some people have said, wow, what a wonderful way to sort of stir up interest in the show. And then other people have said, well, it seems like they just can't, you know, like it's a loss leader, like they can't wait to get rid of it. I think the main thing is that the networks working, you know, putting things on the internet and in network speak, trying to monetize them, nobody exactly knows what's going to happen or what the best thing to do is. It's such a new thing for all of them. So they're willing to try everything and anything. And in this particular case, I think it is good because it allows people, you know, this is a new show that we can't afford to be too precious with it and too withholding of it. It's better to share it and get people interested in it. Because I think if people watch it and they don't like it, they wouldn't, you know, we would have only had them for one episode on the TV anyway. And if they watch it and like it, I think they'll want to see it on TV because it's still, thank God, is not a completely pleasant experience to watch something on a computer screen.
Well, one other thing is that the good news is that you have a 6-week run on Thursday night in a year where NBC has really done a lot of challenging, interesting, quality comedies and built a little following. Bad news is it's opposite Grey's Anatomy and CSI.
Right. But those shows, aren't people really starting? It's about over for those shows.
You timed your premiere right when you knew that Grey's was going to peak.
Interesting. Interest was waning. They're just going to be like, this is just, you know, I've had enough with the medical stuff, the crime stuff.
We need more CPAs.
Yes. Yeah, more CPAs on TV. So more someone like, as it said in Daily Variety, who's bland and doughy. That's in an otherwise wonderful review, they had to point out that I'm bland and doughy.
But I don't think you're bland, and I don't even think you're doughy. I think on this show.
Well, thank you very much.
What was your fitness
regimen? I called our executive producer, and I said, why didn't you tell me I was bland and doughy? We could have done something. There are filters they can put in the camera. My fitness regimen was to go to work because every day it seemed like I was running from someone shooting me or you know, someone was trying to kill me with a rake. So it was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of running, more sprinting than I've done in the last 20 years.
We'll hear more from Andy Richter and our TV critic David Bianculli after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our TV critic David Bianculli's interview with Andy Richter about his new NBC sitcom, Andy Barker, P.I.
Let me finally just ask you some questions about late night, which is where most people saw you for the first time and saw you for several years as the right-hand man to Conan O'Brien. What exactly made you decide that enough was enough there?
Oh, there wasn't any one thing. I had always known at some point that I was going to have to leave. I did not want to be Ed McMahon, and there isn't anything against. I in absolutely no way mean that as an insult to Ed McMahon.
Mm-hmm.
But I set out to be a comedic actor, not a broadcaster. I didn't want to be a broadcast personality. I wasn't really that interested as a profession in being Andy Richter. I wanted to be, you know, wear wigs and mustaches and talk with funny accents and do pratfalls. So I always knew from the beginning that because this was slightly off, you know, that show is Conan's dream come true. And for me, it was just a great, not just, but it was a great job and a wonderful experience and probably will always be the best thing that ever happened to me career-wise.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always kind of going to be a side trip at some point because I had started out trying to be a comedic actor, a character actor in comedies. And I was already on that path when the Conan show happened, so I just had sort of a sense that it would be wonderful to work on that and get the experience and get the notoriety and then at some point get off before people thought of me as nothing but a sidekick or that I would never be anything but a sidekick.
Hmm.
That it would become, I felt that there would be a point at which it would be impossible for people to think of me as anything but that. And it was already difficult when I was... did Andy Richter Controls the Universe, we had our first table read, which is, you know, the first actually public performance mm-hmm. of the script. And one of the really higher-ups at Paramount came up to me afterwards and said, wow, you can really act. you know, and I just felt like, well, what were you paying me for? You know, but then I had to remember, well, this is a town full of singers who can't sing and writers who can't write, so it's not. I guess it's not that far fetched to hire an actor who can't act.
But I guess it was a determination you would have hoped they would have made before they gave you the series.
Precisely. I mean, you know, if I couldn't have acted, it would have been all the more lucky for me that they didn't make the decision beforehand. But I think it took people. You know, there are a number of people who are like, isn't he that sidekick guy? As if that was all that I could do. So I felt like I was going to have to, like I knew that there would be a point when I'd have to hop off the train.
And then finally, now that Conan is in line to get the actual Tonight Show,
mm-hmm.
You could have, had you stayed, actually been Ed McMahon, not just
yeah.
a postmodern Ed McMahon.
Yep.
You've already said that, you know, that didn't interest you because of the other things that you wanted to do in terms of writing and performing. But further in your career is this something that you and Conan have ever talked about or that you have thought about perhaps, given that it is the Tonight Show, going back, even if for a while?
No. No.
Well, that sort of ends any further speculation on that point.
I mean, you know, Jonathan Groff and I have joked that the Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien is our retirement plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's our safety net. Should we fall through every other showbiz crack, we'll land there. You know, even if it's just, you know, writing the jokes about a middle-aged Britney Spears.
It's not a shabby plan B, you know.
No, it's not bad at all.
All right, well, listen, Andy Richter, thank you very much for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you, David.
That was our TV critic David Bianculli interviewing Andy Richter about his new sitcom, Andy Barker, PI, which airs Thursday nights on NBC. We'll close with another scene from the show featuring Andy talking to his wife. I'm Terry Gross.
Andy, you could have been killed, running around in back alleyways in the middle of the night like a crazy man.
I know.
Might I remind you that you are an accountant who has a meeting tomorrow with Ron Davies?
I know. It's just figuring the whole thing out, finding Nikolai. I enjoyed it. It was a rush.
Andy, are you doing pot?
You know that feeling that I get when I hit the equal sign on the calculator and the number on the calculator is the same number that's on the worksheet? It felt like that, honey.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Power of a Positive No, How to Say No and Still Get to Yes by William Urey, author of Getting Past No. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Water Partners International, supported by the Agora Foundation, working to bring safe drinking water to people in the developing world at water.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Iraqis who have been working with Americans in Iraq are seen as collaborators and are targeted for murder, but they've gotten little or no protection from America, according to George Packer's New Yorker article, Betrayed. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with Packer, and national security expert Daniel Byman will discuss the ripple effects of the war. Join us for the next Fresh Air.